Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA, to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, it's time for Context and Clarity Live, where we spend an hour every Thursday afternoon searching for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect. And it doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm or if you own your own firm. Maybe you dream of starting your own thing. Maybe you've even said that 2021's my year and you're on the runway to starting your own thing. Or maybe you have had a firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years and you're starting to rethink or reimagine what that firm could or maybe even should be. All of the topics that we cover fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they're all the need-to-know topics for the success of architects just like you. If we've never met before, my name is Jeff Eccles, and what you're about to listen to is the audio recording of a conversation that my co-host Catherine McPhail and I had last week with our Context and Clarity guest. Every week, we have a new guest and a new topic, so let's jump right into the conversation. All right, Entree Architect community, it's 4 p.m. Eastern, which means it's time for the Entree Architect Context and Clarity Live conversation for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. The reason that we come here every weekday afternoon, or specifically for Context and Clarity Live every Thursday afternoon, is so that we can find clarity around the things that matter most to architects. It doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm or you own your own firm. You may have circled a date on the calendar and said 2021 is my year, and you may be on the way to starting your own thing, or you may have owned your own firm for a year or 10 years or 26 years. You may be rethinking or reimagining what that firm could or maybe even should be. All of the topics that we cover, one topic every day, they're all the need-to-know topics for the success of small firm architects just like you. So thank you for joining us today. Let us know when you get here. Let us know that you're here. Let us know where you're joining the conversation from. If we've never met before, my name is Jeff. I'm in Indianapolis, and I'm joined as usual on these special Thursday Context and Clarity Live conversations by my co-host, Catherine McPhail, who is not in Massachusetts today.
No, nope, I am.
Where are you?
Hi, I'm in Arizona.
Arizona?
Yeah, I know. Why it's pretty far away. I'm here for a Women in Podcasting conference.
Very nice.
Which will start right when I'm done with this. Yeah.
Excellent. So you are far away, but it seems like you're just as close as you always are.
It does feel that way.
It does indeed. And to those of you that are joining us from the future, meaning listening to this on the podcast version, welcome. Thank you for joining us via the Context and Clarity podcast. Many of you in our live audience hear us talk about this all the time. Context and Clarity is also a podcast in addition to a Clubhouse room every weekday morning. You can find the Context and Clarity podcast wherever you consume podcasts. Every Monday, we publish the audio-only version of this conversation, and then every Tuesday, we publish what we call Context and Clarity Backstage. After we're done with our conversation here with our special guest today that I almost accidentally revealed, we go backstage. Catherine and I go backstage with a mystery guest, and we basically break down the conversation. What are our big takeaways? What did we learn? And most specifically, what are how can we take what we learned and apply it to our own businesses? So check out the Context and Clarity Backstage podcast, same place that you find Context and Clarity podcast. It comes out at noon on Tuesday afternoons, noon Eastern on Tuesday afternoon. So a couple of ways that you can find the podcast version of Context and Clarity, or versions that you can find of the Context and Clarity podcast. So let's see who's joined us. Ryan Shoup, welcome back from New Jersey, a Facebook user also joining us from we don't know where, which is a great reminder. If you would like to appear like Ryan does right now on the screen, his name and his profile picture show up. You are joining us. If you're joining us from Facebook, you're joining us from a private Facebook group, the Entre Architect Community Facebook group. Because of Facebook's privacy policies, your information cannot be released from Facebook. It can't talk to Restream, which is this platform that we use right now, unless you give permission for that to happen. So if you want to show up like Ryan does, or like Mark LePage does, hi Mark, or Janine, all of them show up with their name and their picture. So in order to do that, go to the URL that's at the bottom left of your screen right now, chat.restream.io/FB as in Facebook. And then you too can appear as your name and likeness instead of just a Facebook user. So I see Sarah Lee out there on Facebook. I see Scott Thrift joining us from sunny San Francisco via Twitch. Merritt also from Twitch. Let's see who is joining us from somewhere else. I think that's Diego joining us from YouTube in Nicaragua.
Wow.
And Tim Dearborn from Stockton, California, and LinkedIn. So we've got all of the platforms that we stream live to covered right now. So great to have all of you as you continue to join us. Got a good number up on the screen already. So as you get here, say hi. Even if you're just planning to listen in or multitask, that's all right. At least say hi. Let us know that you're here and let us know where you're joining the conversation from. One of the Facebook users is actually David Robertson from Atlanta. So welcome, David. Glad you're joining us today as well. And I see Ed in Des Moines and several others. I see Rod down there from the front porch in Monroe, Louisiana with a cigar and a cappuccino. Well, that seems like you're living your best life. Rod, thanks for joining us. I hope you brought enough to share, actually. I'm glad you're here with us. And anybody else that's out there, say hi. What have I forgotten, Catherine?
I think you pretty much covered it. But you know what I forgot to tell you is that while I'm here in Phoenix, I'm going to see Janine and Nicole, and Michelle's coming over from San Diego. So we're having a mini reunion, I guess.
Excellent.
So I'm excited about that.
Very good.
That's one of the great things about this community is that I just have friends all over the country now.
It is all over the world, actually.
All over the world.
That's one of the things that always boggles my mind is that we often have audience members joining us from the East Coast to the West Coast of the U.S., as well as, jumping oceans over to some of the African countries, some of the countries in the UK, sometimes from the Middle East, the Philippines, and fairly often from Australia. So we do wrap the globe with these conversations, and that's why we ask, tell us where you are. It's fun to see where all these conversations spread. I think you will be really interested and excited in today's conversation because we're going to touch on some innovation. We're going to touch on some topics that you deal with probably as an architect, you deal with in your day-to-day work. Some things that might frustrate you from time to time, as we've learned in our different Context and Clarity conversations this week. So with that, why don't I go ahead and introduce our guest, who is right now currently in the green room, eating pineapple on pizza, but not raisins in cookies, which makes me very happy. I'm just saying that right now.
Yeah, we did get to the bottom of it, in case anybody's wondering from this morning.
We got to the bottom. We got to the bottom. We're not going to hold the pineapple thing against him. Our guest today is trained as an architect and has global experience in the profession. He's a design thinker and an entrepreneur. He's always looking for better, simpler workflows. He's the co-founder and the CEO of UpCodes. Scott Reynolds, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Thanks so much for having me. It's surreal being on this side of the screen rather than the comments section. So thank you for the invite and great to be here.
We're really happy to have you here. And I should have mentioned that you are a member of the Entree Architect community, and you have been on the other side in the comments section. So we thank you for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great community. So glad to be part of it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. And for those of you that are new, and I'm looking down the list now to see how many, if I can recognize names of new members. If you're not familiar, Entree Architect Community has close to 7,400 members in the Facebook group, and they are literally from around the world. And I just looked the other day, and on a month-to-month basis, there are something like 5,300 active users, which is sort of mind-boggling in terms of Facebook statistics. So it is a great community. We're glad to have you as part of that community as well, Scott. So, I mentioned that you're trained as an architect. You have experience, and maybe as sort of the side door into your backstory, I mentioned that you're the co-founder with your brother and CEO of Upcodes. Why Upcodes? Where did the idea come from, and why'd you create something called Upcodes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just give a little bit of some context here. So there is some construction going on next to me. They were hammering a minute ago. Can't complain, because that's all, it's what we do. So multifamily is going on beside us. So just in case there is some hammering.
No worries.
But how did I initially get into it? And it was very much my experience working in architecture. So just like you said, that's my background. Studied at Syracuse University, graduated, went abroad pretty quickly. First did an internship in London. Actually, that was for a graphics design company. It was a little bit of a segue into architecture. Just not a lot of jobs at that time. So took this kind of like a couple month internship in London, but eventually landed in Hong Kong. Started working for an Australian firm, Hassell, based out of Hong Kong, and was my first real exposure to the reality of getting things built. So you go through academia, you learn, I think, a lot of design concepts, depending on your university, but we didn't learn all that much about the reality of putting something together. So in the first position, facing building codes, mechanical codes, plumbing codes, accessibility for the first time and having massive hurdles. The codes are complicated, but when you're working in Cantonese codes, where all our projects were in mainland China, even more difficult, or so I thought, at least at the time. So I worked with this Australian firm for a while, transferred to Cone Pearson Fox, our KPF, an American firm with a satellite office in Hong Kong, did the same thing. So mainland China projects, typically high rise commercial podium buildings, sometimes podium mixed use at the bottom. And got a little bit, tired of just being the passing information, figuring out what are the codes with the boots on the ground and in at the project sites and our design office, whether it was in Sydney or Perth with Hassell or New York City with KPF, and decided to move to the US. Said, hey, I want to be on the design side. I want to start designing some of these buildings, not necessarily the one who passes the design constraints or the codes to our design teams. Lo and behold, it came stateside, and the codes are way more complicated. Now they're written in English, easier for me at least to understand, but significantly more complex. And you have to adhere to them much more diligently, let's say, than some other places abroad. Where I thought I was going to go into an easier space in terms of managing codes, it was significantly harder. So that's when I kind of realized, there must be a better way. There must be a tool or something to help us along and figure out what are the requirements for these buildings. And at the time, my brother was working in as a software engineer at PlanGrid. So a couple of folks here might have come across PlanGrid at some point in time. He joined there in its early days. But I one Thanksgiving, I brought him over to New York City, where I was living at the time, and said, can we use software? Can we leverage software to develop some tools around this? And that was kind of the beginning of Upcodes. Always meant to be a side project, but just got more and more traction as we kind of put it out there, shared it with colleagues, shared it with my network. And that's kind of the origin story, but I'll pause there to see if Is any, any questions?
You said you graduated, or when you graduated, when you did your internship with the graphic design house in London, that there weren't a lot of jobs. What year did you graduate?
Graduated in 2011. So this is coming off the tail end of the recession and everyone here knows, but architecture gets hit really hard. And while the economy was recovering, I'm sure everyone will remember this, but like the jobs were lagging quite a bit. And I think I was looking for a very specific type of firm, international projects, get to travel a little bit and experience the world. So for that very kind of niche kind of position, there was few and far in between until I got to Hong Kong, and it was a different story there.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. I was thinking, in terms of timing, and I listened to the interview that you did with Mark LePage for the Entree Architect podcast, maybe a couple of years ago now, in COVID time. The Mark mentioned something, and this is what always goes through my mind when we're talking about codes, is my memory of building codes is the big binder, right? With the colored sheets that are the amendments and you're talking about the different layers and how complicated things are. And I see Nicole has joined us from Arizona. She was talking the other morning on Clubhouse because she works, I think Nicole is licensed in something like 13 states or something. And what goes through my head is, wow, yeah, a lot of complicated, a lot of information, not necessarily written in a way that's easy for us to understand. And then you get down to the application, and then you're like Nicole, and you work across lots and lots of jurisdictions. So it makes total sense to me that as a young person in the profession, you go, wow, there's got to be a better way. You decide there has to be a better way. You've tested with your brother, who's a software engineer. What was the next step? What happens after that?
Yeah, and I'll just mention too that example of working across jurisdictions is definitely one of my frustrations. It's one of those things that you shouldn't really be a barrier to entry. Just figuring out like what are the codes, what's applicable, making sure you have all the amendments and the supplements or even getting the right code. That should ideally in an ideal world, that should, you just take that for granted. Like that should be the starting line. And then the hard part is designing or putting the buildings together. That's what we all get trained as. And I think that's the interesting hard part of the process. So the kind of inefficiencies of figuring out what's applicable, I think is one of the things we're trying to tackle, certainly. But sorry, it's a bit of a tangent. To go back to your question, where did we go from there? So we kind of put it out there as a side project, like I was mentioned before, and it got more and more traction to the point where we're starting to get feedback and requests for like expanding, especially the code coverage. I think we were just focused on New York City at the beginning, so there's a lot of requests from across the country. To an extent, we're like, hey, while this was kind of a fun project, there actually might be something behind it. Maybe it's not just my own pain point. It seems to resonate with a lot of folks. So we both, I don't know what the sequence was, but we both left our respective jobs. So I left KPF, Garrett left PlanGrid. I was in New York City at the time, he was in San Francisco, and we were just the two of us were working remote, putting this together. So I was figuring out what codes are applicable, what codes should we bring on, how should the search engine work? And I had no background in shipping technology products. I mean, I'm still learning just as much today as I was day one, but especially at that time, there's so many hurdles to learning a new workflow. It's, how do you even get these websites stood up? What's the search engine in the background? What does the interface look like? What is user experience design and all these things? And Garrett, fortunately, he had some background to the technical side, but we kept pushing it forward. And eventually I moved to San Francisco so we could be located in the same place and kind of built it from there. And it got more and more traction. And eventually enough traction that we actually took on some outside investment. And to give a little bit more context here, to that point, we were just using savings. So working as an architect, I was, fairly junior, out of school a couple of years, so pretty modest savings. So those savings went down to zero. So the external investment was very welcomed because we weren't like the company wasn't making any money. We were just kind of working on it just to try and get these codes together and make it a useful tool. So it was really helpful to kind of expand the team a little bit and grow it out more from there.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you went through Y Combinator, and some in our audience will understand what Y Combinator is, startup accelerator or startup incubator, if you will, which I assume is what led to the outside investment. When I heard you say in an interview that there's something like 90,000 codes across the United States, how do you go about figuring out what all the codes are? Which I guess in a way is an extension of the previous question. How do you figure out what all the codes are? And then how do you capture all of that to try to roll it into a central place like Upcodes?
Great question. And I think the study was done by The Economist. I think it was 93,000 different building codes across the US when you take into account every single little jurisdiction. So a massive challenge. We still work on it today, but the first 2 years or so was almost exclusively dedicated to building the backend technology that could manage the code repository, basically all of the code library, and manage updates, when supplements would go out, amendments. How do you actually track that? How do you know when that happens? And then once it does happen, how do you actually get that information into the database and assimilate it and bring it in? So there's almost 2 years of development just building that. And it seems very, very simple. But Jeff, to your point, we're trying to go from at the time from inserting into a binder, the very analog method. So there's a lot of work on that front. But today, as we've expanded jurisdictions across the country, we just have full-time people that do that. Some governments are pretty good about being transparent. So two that come to mind, I'm sure there's many more, but New York City, Department of Buildings, California do a great job kind of getting ahead of the curve for the most part, where they announce like codes coming up, changes and things like that. But that's not always the case. So some departments, we're calling them, we're emailing them, we're trying to get more information where you can't on the website, or it's not publicly available. So, and an interesting way, hopefully, if we do that, if we're trying to constantly, not badger, but we're trying to get that information from the departments, then we can kind of democratize that and share that with everybody. Say, hey, heads up, Ohio, they have an interesting supplement or code update in the pipeline or something like that, and we want to try and get ahead of that as much as possible. We're there's a lot of room to improve, but we're constantly trying to not just capture the updates, but then get proactive and get them ahead of time. So like New York City just went into, they just adopted the new set of codes, and that went to, I think, a vote passed end of last week, I believe it was, or maybe the week before that. But getting that transparency, showing people, hey, when you're browsing this section, that section actually might change in the future. Like when you go for permitting, it might look a little bit different than it does today. And how do we start to surface these things? So some of that we've built, but there's just so much more we can do.
Well, I think you pretty much answered the question that I had up on the screen that Ryan asked. So I have a question for you, and this is probably a stupid question, but I'm in Massachusetts, or, that's where I work. And, they always say you should just get the one, only use the code that we give out at the state house. That's it. Don't ever trust any online thing. So I have a hard time trusting Upcodes because of that, of the however many years of them telling me, don't trust anything you see online. You have to make sure in this book that you can only buy from us for $20.
Yeah.
So there's that too.
Yeah. Interesting incentives there.
Yeah.
What I will say, or maybe bring in some case studies or examples. Oftentimes when you do get an edition of the code, that code will change over time. And I'll use one example that happened last week, I believe. Someone wrote in and they said, hey, in California, I have my book and I've inserted the supplements. And I think this section is outdated. And then we said, okay, well, we'll dig into it and all those things and contact the department. But actually, we didn't even need to contact the department. What ended up happening was there was another supplement after that had overridden this historical supplement. So when you're getting these things, they tend to be a snapshot in time, and you should be diligent to be inserting those updates. But more often than not, it can be quite hard to keep up with the amount of information changing for that. So a lot of times it's just a matter of like confusion when we talk to folks. It's like, yeah, they're working off an updated or outdated piece of code. And just one more interesting example is a department. So we worked with one of our clients. They were submitting their application, and then the department said, "Hey, you know, I think it was in California as well, actually, because the supplements are so substantive." And they said, "Hey, I think it's a fixture count," and they're like, "This fixture count is this code," and it ended up being the department who had that update code, and that's just the reality that different parties are operating off different viewpoints or points of information. And a big ambition for us is to bring transparency and consistency to that. So there should never be a question, is the billing department working off the right information? Is the architect working off the right information? Ideally, it's just completely transparent. And I think the only way to do that is through a digital nature where you can keep these things instantaneously up to date.
So along those lines, I mean, do you see that as a way for states to, like as Chris was asking, is there a way for that to more easily happen? He was talking this morning about how he's also in Massachusetts and how it takes about 5 years or so for states to adopt the code. But then do you see a way for that to happen more quickly?
Yeah. And this gets into a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's really interesting. So when we ingest, so that's when we bring the codes into the system, when new codes come out, there's a bunch of QA, QC automated, and then of course human as well. But in the QA, QC, it'll automatically flag potential issues in the code. It says, "Hey, the numbering sequence is not right. There's a conflict in the way the code is structured." So it'll automatically flag those things. And 9 times out of 10, it's an error in the original authoring of the code. So then we reach out to the department and we say, "Hey, here's a laundry list of what we think are going to be code errors," and then they confirm them. They're like, "Yes, this is an error." And then what we do is go on the site and say, like, "Here's a note, user note. This is an error, but it'll be fixed in the next edition." So you can picture that's a very kind of inefficient way to write the code. Like, they write the code, it gets shipped, we get it, we ingest it, we flag all these issues, then we have to go back to them, then they have to confirm that those are mistakes, then they have to catch that in a future update. Now, to go back to Chris's question, I think to make that much more streamlined, I think we can do or have some kind of collaboration where we provide the departments with these tools. It's like, let's catch that error before it ever goes to print. Let's make your authoring process more bulletproof and more reliable than just working in, say, Microsoft Word, where you do have the ability to do things out of order. And numerically, you can make mistakes or there's no kind of validations or checks done by it. So I think that's like a big area that we'd like to look into instead of being kind of retroactive and catching a lot of these errors.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. It might've been Chris that was telling me, he and I were talking the other day, talking about a zoning code, which, you know, not a building code, but some jurisdiction had made some mistake and basically by accident overwritten, if you will, that's probably not the right term, but overwritten their entire zoning code, which of course causes a huge problem. This whole idea of machine learning, AI, technology assisting in this process, really, maybe it's just me, but it must not just be me. It seems to make a whole lot of sense to me because I still feel like at times that we're operating in 2021 and somewhere at ICC, sorry to call ICC out on the carpet, but there must be scribes in a room somewhere with quill pens doing all of this by hand versus the technology that's available to us. So it amazes me the amount of information and data that you're crunching through, which tells us that there's a lot of people that are working really, really hard and inefficiently somewhere else, and there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, I completely agree. It reminds me a lot of comparing CAD to Revit, where CAD is a lot more freeform, and certainly has advantages in certain capacities. But there are a lot of advantages to Revit, which provides a little bit of guardrails. So if you're making it an object, it will kind of define some of those parameters, and at least you have to like opt to get outside of certain parameters. And I think in a similar way, like creating the data in a very structured way, not only prevents there from being errors, but also makes it easy to operate with. So like Jeff, like you're mentioning, like machine learning or AI, the more structured the data, and it doesn't need to be totally structured, but if it's semi-structured, it's significantly easier to work with than just free-form text, which is notoriously difficult.
So speaking of AutoCAD, Revit, you know, whatever, pick your platform, pick your software. I think you've talked before about a way to, I'm going to say, connect upcodes with the software that you're using. Are you still working on that? Is that still a thing, or what's the future of that?
Yeah. So that is definitely the roadmap or the future we want to work towards. And for a brief stint, we did a Revit plugin. So it would look at the BIM and start to identify potential code issues. So it would flag specifically around ADA checks. But the problem was we could look at a bathroom and start to assess it for ADA compatibility. But the problem was, does that bathroom even need to be ADA compliant or not in the first place? We couldn't really answer that. So we had this kind of large scale scoping problem where we didn't know where this building was located, the occupants, or like what the requirements are for this. So we actually took a step back where we said, okay, let's define the requirements. So what is this building? Who's occupying the building? And what is the construction type, sprinklering options? And then we can define, okay, what's the fixture counts? What's your heights and areas? What's the egress, travel distance, fire resistance ratings? And then from there, we can get back into the Revit or any kind of 3D checking. And just as a company, that's what we're focused on today. And is the what we call code calculators, defining the scoping requirements for the building and generating a code sheet. And then ideally in the near future, that'll unlock us to get back into BIM model checking, where then we can say, okay, we know you need this many fixtures. Here's your ADA scoping, heights and areas, travel distance. And then we can go through and document and start to flag issues and kind of queue up that code report for the AHJ.
That's amazing. That you could do, if you could do that, that would be pretty amazing.
It's going to take a lot of work. I'll just say that it's when you dive into the 3D land, it's and especially Revit, very, very messy data, unfortunately from Autodesk, but it's challenging, but I think it'll be worth it.
Well, to follow up on that, we had a question this morning. Will you end up selling to Autodesk or Amazon? Cause Amazon buys everything, but Autodesk makes more sense probably.
Yeah. It's really interesting because there tends to be these convergence of software. So like, I think everyone seems to be, when I say everyone, I mean, the big players seem to be moving towards having like a suite of tools. But I think where we want to take the company, I don't think would be all that compatible with some of these large, like Autodesk, trying to think of some other big players in the space. It'll come back to me, that the other one's thinking of, but they bought Aconex. There is this convergence, but I think in a way you give up your roadmap and it's going to be shaped towards what they view and the way they view the world. And I think there is a huge amount of benefit to being independent, where you can try and define what you want the workflows to be, not answering or in service of this other product, if that makes sense.
And we have one request to not do that. So
then it sounds like we're aligned. I'm glad.
Well, you mentioned workflow, and I think probably that's in a way the most important thing that we're talking about here. And one, I don't remember if it was yesterday in our context and clarity conversation or if it was this morning on Clubhouse, but I think it was yesterday. I think it was Javier was talking about how he learned to do code research. So, and you created this, I mean, you were relatively young in the field when you created this, not right out of school, obviously, but, I think there are many people in the profession that are, you know, they're out of school for several years before they're really digging too deep into building code. So what's the difference with a tool like Upcodes versus the binder on the shelf? What's the difference for a young person that's making their way in the profession and learning things like how to do code review and or simply how to look things up, I guess, you know, maybe not even putting together a code sheet, but what's the difference in the way that they're able to research and learn now with a tool like this?
Yeah. So I think in a couple areas, and starting from basic to more advanced, from a very basic level, just searching and cutting across your jurisdiction. So lifting out the, when you're executing a search in say like Ohio or Massachusetts or Florida, Texas, cutting through that whole jurisdiction and lifting out codes from not just the building code or let's say an ICC based adoption. And I think I saw in the chat, like NFPA, but a lot of the codes are written in non-compatible formats. And people have probably come across that more times than they would like to, or they're like at all, especially when it comes to NFPA versus ICC. But now that we've brought those codes into kind of a consolidated ecosystem, so to answer that question really quickly. So we do have a lot of NFPA based adoptions, which is new as of a couple months ago. But executing a search and then lifting out the relevant codes and maybe if there's a more stringent code. So especially if you're more junior, you might be looking exclusively at, let's say, the mechanical code or the building code or residential code, not knowing that there's a more restrictive code in another publication. So that's like a very simple kind of way kind of cutting through and searching can help. And then kind of the middle step is illustrations and diagrams. So to engage with this topic that codes are very hard to interpret and to understand how they apply to your project, we've started to layer on top diagrams that help unpack the code or examples. So it could say, okay, here's like gross versus net area. Here's an example of how you might go about that or to explain it in a visually and then with plain English. Or an example like 1 hour, 2 hour fire rated wall or an assembly. So attaching these visual diagrams and then in that diagram, linking the code. So it's like, here's a topic. You are looking at a 2 hour fire rated wall via this section, but here's five other sections you should be looking at as a heads up. Like you can't just look at one place in the code. So that's the second one is layering on top these diagrams and visual unpackings of the code, as an intermediate step. And then I would say like the most advanced way would be doing the code calculators. So going to the inputs, this is where we're located. This is the occupants. This is the construction type and playing with those inputs and seeing all the downstream code implications. Because you'll get the code sheet and you can go and change your construction type or change maybe the gross area on a certain occupancy and see what the downstream impact would be. Or is this a horizontal separation and what construction types can I use? And there's a ton of guides that says, okay, if you are using this horizontal separation, there's restrictions on the occupancies you can have above that. So building a lot of these guides, but also flags and validations to start to determine, say, hey, there might be an issue with this proposed design. So a lot of that is built into the product. And then lastly with that, when you do have your code sheet, each module, so let's say like building height has an explanation. So there's a little explanation button you can click and it'll walk through step by step. This is how you get to the end result. So it's by no means like a black box. You can say, this is how my project maps across all the different formulas and lookup tables, and you can track your whole project through it. And that's all linked back to the code. So we're always encouraging, especially the junior folks, to get back into the code. So yes, like we did the calculation for you, but here's the proof of work. And you should be looking at those sections to get familiar. This is where we're pulling those sections from. So obviously helps with the calculation and documentation, but education is a big component of that.
You had me at the wall types, because the minute you said this, I had this visceral memory of sitting at my desk with multiple code books opened, right? Because you're looking,
right,
you know, what,
right.
You got to have a 2 hour separation. Okay. What's that? Right. And we've got another book open. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
I think the top five most popular diagrams, I think there's a 1 hour fire partition, 2 hour firewall, a grade plane calculation. I forgot what the other two of the top five are, but I think you and a lot of other folks, they found a lot of value.
That's tremendous. So what about, this is another thing, because a lot of our community are probably almost all of our community, small firm architects. Many are residential, do mainly residential work. Some will do, for the majority of their career, will do a specific project type in a specific jurisdiction or very close to that. So what's the benefit of, again, something like UpCodes for an architect that may do custom homes in, I don't know, in upstate New York, as a for instance, where, you know, they're maybe not going all that deep into all the sections of the code all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's it's also a great use case. And I was just chatting with someone this morning about that. So there's shared projects, and sorry, I'm diving into all these different workflows.
That's good.
But you can create a project or a template for a building. So if you're going to do a lot of the same kind of project types, you can create a template or just crib off of a historical project, but you have a kind of a description of the project. You have all your bookmarks, of the relevant code, the annotations. If you do want to use the code calculators, those are there as well. And you can create that template and then just keep duplicating. So it's like rinse and repeat. Don't do the code report or the code analysis from the ground up every time. You can start from the 50-yard line. It's like, you know, upstate New York, we've deployed a bunch of these projects before. Let's duplicate a historical one, or maybe someone in the office has created a template, duplicate that template, rename it, and then tweak it for that given project. But a big part of what we focus on is the ability to retain a lot of the code research and knowledge internally so that you can apply that to future projects. So if you're working on the same project over and over, it's actually a really good use case for it in an interesting way.
Yeah. And so I designed a custom home today, 2021, upstate New York. And then I don't know what the right time frame would be, but let's say I do another one in 2023, code may have changed. And so I've got that template, but it's going to be updated, right? With as the code is updated.
Mm-hmm. So great question. That's actually what we're working on now is updating it, migrating it to either different jurisdictions or updated code years. So let's say you had one in the 2015 New York State, and you want to bring that to the 2020 edition. You could, shortly in the future, you'll be able to say, okay, duplicate it, but update it to this new set. Or if you're working in New York State and you want to go to Connecticut or Massachusetts, you could say, we have a very similar project, duplicate that and tweak it for Massachusetts, and then automatically flag where the codes differ. So if a section doesn't exist or they have a new exception or removed an exception that you're using, it can automatically flag that. So it could say, yes, it's 90% the same between these two different code editions or jurisdictions, but here's where it differs, and we'll just bring that to your attention so you can tweak the project.
That's pretty amazing. So as we think about the way that codes are developed now, and we sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, in the future, do you see yourself, meaning you, UpCodes, or simply enough critical mass behind an idea like UpCodes, do you see that having an impact on the way that codes are written and organized?
So I certainly hope so, to answer that concisely. But I think, I think there was a context and clarity session recently that I dropped this one term in there, but it's actually there's a lot to unpack there, and it's called refactoring. So it's a concept in software engineering where you take your historical code that you wrote, and then you try and write it. So it's going to output exactly the same thing, but you clean it up. Because the first time you did it, you maybe don't know all the context, and there's a certain variables that you don't know at the time. But in hindsight, you can actually make that considerably smaller or cleaner, and that's called refactoring. So and typically gives exactly the same output. But when people write the code, it's always additive, so it always gets more complex, and it always goes in one direction. So as the committees work on it, it's very very infrequently made more simple or consolidated. So I think when we go through and we're mapping out all the different calculations, we're seeing all the inefficiencies because we have to do it very binary, because software doesn't like vagueness. So you have to make decisions and you always have to err on the right side. But there's a ton of opportunities to consolidate the codes and make them simpler while maintaining, you know, the same safety standards. So that's one way we would love to get involved, is to say, hey, we're gonna help with the code, but specifically we don't want to add anything to the code. I just want to make it more simple. We'll get you the same end results, but in 50% of the verbiage. And it'll be more precise too. So less opportunities to interpret the wrong way.
So what will it take to convince somebody, or is that the biggest hurdle? Is it to convince the current powers that be to change that? What's the tipping point, or is there, do you think there is a tipping point out there that reverses the trend of always being additive?
Yeah, that's a great question. And sorry, I just want to mention quickly, Ryan. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Like, value engineering is exactly what it is. So what is that leverage point or critical mass to get to that point? When we look at collaborating with the HJs, like showing them when we've automatically flagged potential issues when they send out the supplements or errata or even new code updates, they're 90% of the time they're extremely receptive, because we're just trying to help them. It's like, hey, we're not trying to do this to get anything back. It's just, here's all these code issues that we don't like. You're kind of forcing your hand. That's the code. That's the law. We got to do it as you told us. But we have to write a bunch of caveats so the users know. But in an ideal world, that doesn't exist at all. So I think it's just a win-win. So at least in that experience, there's never been pushback or them not wanting to adopt that. So I think as long as their incentives are, you know, to make cleaner, faster, more efficient codes, I think it works pretty well. I can't say everybody has the same incentives, but I think for the most parts, with most, if not all departments we've worked with, it's been the case.
So there's an ongoing lawsuit right now, which we can touch on, but skipping ahead maybe a step or two, is there ever a scenario that you can see where you're somehow teamed up with the ICC?
Yeah, good question. I think, we would like that. Like, I think if it's a more collaborative than combative would be great. To say this delicately, like, I think a lot of the SDOs have seen the world a certain way and they're very resistant to seeing it a different way. And they've made massive quantities of money from that. And I think they're very incentivized to not have things change. So it is a bit of a more difficult conversation when the way they're incentivized, there's no reason for them to modernize that process or introduce these things. Cause it's like, well, things have been pretty good for the last 20 years for us. So like, why do we want anything to change? So we've, So to answer your question, ideally it's collaborative. Hopefully we get there at some point. But I think it's, they're gonna have to be a little bit more flexible in how they view the world.
Yeah. You're breaking their business model at this point, I guess.
Well,
Just to
chime in on that for just really quickly. So they are a nonprofit technically, despite their salaries. But if you look at the amount, their revenue line items, publication sales, so actually selling the book or the online subscriptions, account for less than 15% of the revenue. So when they say that, oh, this is, you know, critical for the organization going forward, it's like, well, it only represents 15% of your revenue. So that's pretty interesting. The bulk of the revenue comes from accreditation programs and kind of all the auxiliary content around being a publisher.
So Ed wanted to know about pricing. He says, I am perusing the UpCode's website. Scott, please elaborate on some of the subscription offerings, code calculator, code sheet, export, code diagram. And I'm also going to throw in another possible one that I was thinking, because I'm one of those people who just does residential in Massachusetts right now. So to me, like, is there, would it be possible to have a little mini subscription just for that one thing? Okay. And that's it. Yeah. Next question.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Good question. So as a little bit of background, kind of one of the big pillars of the company is that code is so complicated to begin with. Anything that's not the code, like all the supporting auxiliary content, should be as simple as possible. So when we thought about pricing, we said, okay, let's just make it as simple and straightforward as possible. It's going to be one price, and it's just going to be the whole suite. And so the benefit is, like, yes, it is more simple. I guess the downside to your point is that, like if you have like a smaller set of features that you want to use, it maybe doesn't work as well. So we're still trying to figure it out. Sorry, that's like a bit of a non-answer, but right now it's just one.
No, that's an answer.
One price, and it's just the whole suite and right. Everything going forward too.
So well, I'm going to write you a note to remind you about how that would be, because the feeling, like, sure. I feel like I've been doing it for so long that I know what certain things are, but then they change over mm-hmm. time. So anyway, so it's not really, for me, it would be expensive to have the subscription every month when I'm not really going to look at it that often, you know, possibly. Mm-hmm. But then when I don't look at it, I would be in trouble. So I should just have something I could check all the time. So that's just the way I feel about it.
And an interesting thing there, just really quick thought. One of the, for that use case, one of the features is code compare. So you can look at the changes in code. So you could say, okay, I'm working on this edition. Has it changed from the earlier edition that I'm very comfortable and I know very well? And it'll highlight exactly where the text has changed. So like, these words have been added, this exception's been added, or this one's been removed. If it's been relocated in the same code, it tells you where it's gone. And then you can go click and you can compare. So it doesn't solve the frequency issue, but hopefully it solves the understanding, has that section changed or has any language.
Yeah, it would just be interesting reading, because honestly, I love rules like that. So
yeah,
I could just read it for fun, I guess.
If you want to see interesting, you should compare whatever jurisdiction you're into, like California or New York City, and then see the differences between those. And it's just, those are the most extreme, where everything gets chopped up and moved all over.
Catherine, I think it would take it from being a code business tool to probably a hobby where you sat around at night and compared all these things and across different jurisdictions.
Right. And if I could only find one or two other people who would also like to do that, we could just have Zoom meetings that we just talk about. Did you see this difference in code? That's fascinating.
You could have a code club.
A code club, exactly.
A code club. You have a code club.
Right.
The UpCode's code club.
Yeah, I can see my life getting really exciting.
It could be exciting.
We've actually chatted a bunch about, you know, we didn't call it the code club, but basically like a forum. Like, can we create some place where folks can talk to each other and maybe it's differences or helping analyze, you know, what this section means. And we're still trying to wrap our heads around it. So, I mean, I'd love to hear from the community, but what we're trying to figure out is that there is a risk of someone who might have a high degree of confidence, but not know the section that well. So they might come in and answer and say, like, this is what it is, but it might not be correct, and therefore, like, a little bit challenging to parse the signal from the noise. But I think there's something there, because if we can pool our knowledge together and then just have this open discussion and forum, then hopefully we can surface some of these answers.
But yeah, it would just be for code nerds. It wouldn't really be for information, because we go to you for information. We would just sit around and, I don't know, talk about code for fun. Someone else was writing, had written earlier about zoning. Could you do that for zoning? But that would be impossible. I feel like there's no way on earth you could do that. That would be every single town in the whole country would have a different.
Yeah. So exactly that. It differs to such a high extent depending on your geography or where you're based. It's almost impossible to scale up across. And in fact, there's a couple of companies, Envelope.city, I think out of New York. I think there's one in the Midwest or the West, forget their name, but there are a couple that tackled that, but the scaling, getting outside of your jurisdictions, is extremely difficult.
Do you have any competitors?
Well, this kind of goes back to the legal aspect. I think we would have competitors if they hadn't been kind of artificially suppressed in the last 10 years. We've connected with a lot of folks who said like, hey, we wanted to do something very similar to what we're doing today or something else, but related. Like someone was talking about like a firewall calculator, and it just helped a ton with sprinklering codes and like fire codes and do all these things. And at companies too, not just individuals. And we've talked to so many folks that wanted to do that, but just got really threatening, nasty letters from the lawyers. And who knows what those tools could have become if the ecosystem of codes was more open. So hopefully going forward, now that we've laid down more and more case law that yes, these things enter the public domain when they're adopted into law, no one can copyright the law, which should be obvious, but like you do need the judges to say that. Hopefully people start to come in and develop in all sorts of tools and areas. And I think ideally it'd be just as thriving and robust as other industries. So if you look at lawyers or you look at really anyone else, when it comes to their tool set, they have a bunch of different options to choose from. So maybe in 5 years, it you might choose from three or four very strong options, and maybe they're unique to say like residential, or maybe they're unique to commercial or this part of the country. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it now that things are opening up substantially.
That's excellent. That's excellent. It this whole idea of democratizing it all makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so Ryan wanted to know which would be better or worse, Code Club or Door Hardware Club. It is hard to choose. They're totally different things. You could have both. Well, I don't know. You don't have to have one or the other. Door Hardware Club would be kind of fun, actually, I think.
You know, I don't know if anyone's come across it, but there's a website called I Dig Hardware, I think it is. And it's a little bit bigger than just Door Hardware, but it's pretty in line, actually. So we that one might be taken.
Okay, well, I'll have to go join it.
Great articles, actually.
You can see exactly where Ryan's interests are. So, you know, I'm envisioning we need a couple of shirts here. There's one that says Code Nerd. There's one that says Door Nerd, maybe.
And there's one that just says Nerd, and it covers everything. I mean, you can have a variety of interests if it just says Nerd.
This is true. Is true. Up Nerd. Scott, this has been a fantastic and fascinating conversation. Really just, you know, you kind of hit in an area that really intrigues me about the future of the profession. We're going to have somebody on Context and Clarity Live in the near future to talk about AI and architecture. And I'm always fascinated. Catherine's shaking her head.
It's almost over for us, Jeff. We're almost going to be replaced by these.
Not
robots.
Until Skynet.
Oh boy.
But I love what you're doing here. Again, I'm most of the community knows that I am blissfully unaware of code research these days, and I'm not a UpCode user because of that. But I'm just fascinated by what I see and what I hear and what I see you doing. So thank you for joining us today and sharing all this information with us.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me and for everyone that joined. And I'll just mention too, most of us come from industry but haven't practice in now a couple of years. So the only way we keep our finger on the pulse for what to build is by connecting with the community. So if there is code coverage or features or anything like that you'd love to see or like to see, definitely let us know. My email is scott@upcodes, or you know, you can reach out to us on LinkedIn or Twitter or directly over the website. We just love to connect with the community and always here to chat. So if you have any ideas or anything like that, we'd love to connect.
Yeah, that's excellent. I appreciate that. So everybody, you know, whether you're in the live audience right now or you're listening in the future on the podcast version, Scott mentioned it, right? He wants to hear from the community. And I think that ties directly into what they're doing here at UpCodes. Give them a shout out whichever way makes sense, and help them make what they're doing better and more useful to you. I'm really looking forward to seeing where all of this goes. So thanks again, Scott. And to all of our audience here, whether you're live right now or listening in the future on the podcast, thank you. Thanks for all your questions and your comments here live. Thanks for making Context and Clarity a thing. I say this every week because it's true. If it weren't for all of you, we wouldn't be having this conversation with Scott right now. We just turn the corner. I guess it was last Wednesday. So you heard this at the end of last week's episode as well. Last Wednesday was 18 months of daily context and clarity conversations. And I don't have any idea how many of these context and clarity lives that we've done now, but that's only because of all of you. That's all only because all of you show up and you say, hey, this is what we're interested in. These are the questions we have. You attend and you drive these conversations. So I thank all of you for that, for making context and clarity thing. Catherine, as always, thank you for co-hosting this with me. Enjoy Arizona and say hello to Nicole and Janine and Michelle while you're there in your your mini context and clarity reunion, I suppose, your get together out there, and also the podcast conference there. So with that, everybody, again, appreciate all of you wherever you are and whenever you're listening or watching this. Take care of yourselves. Be well, be safe, take care of those that are around you, and find a little bit of time to breathe tonight. Relax a little bit, rejuvenate, because we're going to do this again tomorrow in a context and clarity conversation format. And next week, we'll be back here again, Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, live, and Jonathan Siegel will be our guest next Thursday. We'll talk about architect as developer with Jonathan next Thursday. So I hope you will join us wherever you consume context and clarity. And until then, I hope that I will see you somewhere sometime soon. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, well, there you have it. What did you think of that conversation? Hopefully there was some big takeaway that will help you this week with your business. If there was, let me know. DM me on Instagram or on Twitter. You can find me on all the socials at Jeff_Eccles. So send me a message and let me know what your takeaway was. And if you want more conversations like this, subscribe to the Context and Clarity podcast and leave us an honest review and rating. Those things really help us get the message out and help us help more architects just like you. Oh, and follow Context and Clarity on Instagram as well, so you can get a heads up on everything that's coming up. In our next episode, Catherine will join me again along with a special guest, or will it be guests from the Context and Clarity community, so we can break this conversation down. It will be Context and Clarity backstage, so to speak. So join us as we all share our biggest takeaways and look for ways to apply what we heard in today's conversation to our own businesses. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment, and it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know that you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. And finally, if today's topic is of particular interest to you, and you'd like to dig deeper into it, then join me over in the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern, I host Context and Clarity conversations, and we take these topics and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time to try to find more clarity around the things that matter most to you. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community, your practice, and how you can support those around you. Catherine and I will be back for our next episode. And in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook today at 4 p.m. Eastern, so that we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context may be.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.